We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, too.
We actually are, as people know from a couple weeks ago, we are pre-recording this until we come up with something better, which our lab people are working on as we speak. So, and last night there was passing of Representative John Lewis. Actually, it was yesterday.
Yeah. It's actually the second major passing of a civil rights icon in 24 hours on evening. C.T. Vivian passed, who became a reverend later in life, but he was actually one of the original SNCC founders and doing sit-ins and lunch counters and things like that as far back as the mid-50s. He passed at the age of 95. And then a day later, John Lewis passed, who went on to become a member for, I believe, 24 years, and really was the conscience of a legislative body that very often doesn't have much conscience. He was very encouraged by the current wave of protests, and in fact went and visited the Black Lives Matter protest in Plaza in D.C. Only a few weeks ago. But he had been diagnosed with very serious cancer, and that was announced about, I think, about 2 months ago. And he passed last night, and he will be terribly missed. And I have to say that, I see that his passing is getting an enormous amount of attention, but many of the people doing the eulogizing of him really could do to take more lessons from his life, because he really personified the courage and the grace that he showed in the civil rights protests in the early 60s, all the way through another 55 years of public service. So he will be terribly missed, and he was a great, great American.
Yes, and a shining example to those others who are representing us in D.C.
Yeah, and for those of us on the streets as well.
So, bouncing back and starting with local news, the Seattle City Council has been busy the last couple weeks.
Yeah. Last week, they passed the jumpstart proposal of Teresa Mosqueda, which is basically a restructured tax Amazon bill. That passed council by a veto-proof set majority. And the way it works is it is a payroll tax, essentially, on a large company's highest paid executives. The city attorney, Pete Holmes, thinks that it's constitutional and will pass the inevitable court challenge. And it has enough votes to survive a veto by Mayor Jenny Durkan, who, of course, is opposed to it. Also passed by a 7-2 margin, and or not passed, but announced by seven members of the city council, announced last week that they would support a 50% reduction in SPD funding, which of course is something that Mayor Durkan is also very much opposed to. The budget committee, which is chaired by Lisa Herbold, has been working on that, and the budget committee had their first hearing this past week looking at how they could structure amendments to the 2020 budget, given that they're going to have to cut a lot of different departments because of the impact of the pandemic and the lost revenue that the city has suffered. The budget recommendations are out now. They will introduce and pass or vote down various amendments next week at 2:00 on Wednesday. And then the full council will vote on the revised 2020 budget. That vote will be on August 3rd. So it's going to be a busy time in council for the next couple of weeks. And it's a very, very good time to contact your district representative and the two at-large representatives and let them know what you think about possible cuts to the city budget. Because obviously, the particularly social services is going to be on the chopping block from the mayor. And hopefully council can restore some of those cuts and keep those social services in place, because a lot of people are being badly hurt by the job loss and the other effects of the pandemic. So very important decisions coming up in the next couple of weeks for City Council.
Shortly after several council members, Teresa Mosqueda and president of Seattle City Council announced that they were Lorena Gonzalez.
Gonzalez.
Yeah. After they publicly announced that they were supporting the 50% cut, both Jenny Durkin and Carmen Best came out on multiple occasions saying that that simply isn't going to work, and you're basically we're going to have to let half the police go. And gosh, it turns out the people we're going to let go are people of color, appeared to be first on the chopping block. Can you talk about any of that a little bit?
Sure. Well, first of all, there were two basic points that Durkin was trying to make, one of which was completely idiotic, which was Durkin was saying that, well, this means that since they want to cut half the budget and we've already through half the year, they just want to abolish the police for the rest of the year. No, that is not what council is proposing at all. They are proposing 50% out of what it remains to be spent for the balance of the year. The second point that Durkin was making was a little more substantive, which was talking about, in order to do this properly and be able to accommodate these cuts, there has to be a plan. There has to be a way to ramp down. Not everybody can be laid off all at once. There's laws and union contracts that prevent that, and payroll is by far the biggest part of the police budget. The council was not consulting with SPD in making these cuts. Of course, a lot of the sentiment behind reducing SPD's budget by 50% is basically to reimagine what public safety looks like and what law enforcement looks like in the city of Seattle, that it doesn't need to all go through SPD. For instance, traffic enforcement can be handled separately. But Durkin is right, actually, that it takes time to train people outside the department to handle the 911 call center, the dispatch, which is one of the first things that's been proposed to be moved out of SPD's purview, that can't be set up right away because you need to have the people to staff it. And those people would be city employees, but they would not be employees of SPD under the proposed restructuring. And that's something Durkin has proposed. It's just going to take time is what she's saying. And she's probably right about that. It's going to be interesting to see because the detailed amendments that council members will be proposing to cut the budget by 50% will come out next week. And at that point, they will have a plan and it'll be up to Durkin to find ways to criticize it because I'm sure she'll oppose it. That is coming, and it's definitely something that Herbolt's Public Safety Committee has been working on. So look for that next week. I would say if you are inclined to attend one of the council meetings online, because they are online now and they're open to the public, both to comment and to listen, next week would be an excellent time to do it. It's 2 p.m. Budget Committee, and you can go to the City Council website to find the portal for that.
Yeah, and if people are interested in speaking during the public comment period, I know you've got to get in line for that, log in a couple hours early if you have it.
At least.
I mean, it's like concert tickets or something.
I would, particularly for something like this where there's going to be a lot of public interest, I would do it as soon as you get up in the morning. And if you search for City Council Agenda under Google, it'll take you right there.
Now, I also saw this week that I believe Mayor Jenny Durkin is refusing to sign the Jumpstart legislation. And since it passed 7-2, it still goes into effect regardless of whether she signs. And she clearly doesn't have enough any power there to veto it at this point.
Well, she can veto it, or she can simply refuse to sign, and it will become law without her signature after a certain number of days.
Okay.
she may want to set that precedent of having a major piece of legislation vetoed by or the veto overridden by, you know, a margin that she can't do anything about. And the other danger of that, of course, is remember that Durkin has a history of refusing to implement budget decisions passed by council, in particular, moving money from programs that she wanted to cut, and then council restored those. Moving the navigation team for moving it to navigation team and some of her other preferred proposals. So that has to be watched as well. And I don't know what has happened to the court challenge around that, but I can't imagine that she has the legal right to do that. It's a very Trump-like move. You know, instead of building border walls, she wants to sweep homeless camps.
Yeah. Well, it seems to be a theme that appears to be happening all across the country.
Yeah.
So at some point, I believe, maybe jumping in now, we have a primary coming up, and we do reviews of who is running and what's on the ballot each cycle, each election. Yep. So is now a good time to tackle that?
Let's do it. The primary is coming up on August 4th, which is 2 weeks from next Tuesday. So people should have gotten their ballots yesterday or the day before in the mail. And of course, there are drop boxes around the around the county, or you can simply you don't even have to stick a stamp on it; just put it back in the mail. So that's coming up. And mostly, what's on the ballot this time? There are actually no ballot initiatives for the first time on my memory. So it's almost entirely different state and federal offices. The only federal offices would be the congressional representatives, and then all the statewide offices as well. So there are a lot. It's a thick ballot voter's guide, but that's because there's a bunch of people running for governor, 36 by my count, plenty from the nut tree. But let's talk first about U.S. representatives. The Seattle area representatives, there's no real drama to any of these. Incumbents are all running for re-election and should win easily in the first district in North Seattle and north into Snohomish County. Susan DelBene has fairly token opposition. Pramila Jayapal in Seattle, also fairly token opposition. And then the South Seattle, South King County, and into Pierce County, Adam Smith is not facing the kind of principled opposition this time that he did last time around, as far as I can tell. So all three of those are likely to be reelected fairly easily. The statewide races in the state legislature are a little more interesting. Jay Inslee, of course, is running for a third term, which has not happened in quite a while in Washington state history. He's got 35 candidates opposing him. The only one with any real name recognition is Tim Eyman, who's running for the Republican as a Republican. Eyman has really been front and center and very visible in leading the protests against mask requirements and the governor's stay-at-home order, which firmly plants him on the side of the unhinged wing of the Republican Party, which I suppose is not a surprise. One of the criticisms of Eyman over the years has been that he offers false choices with his initiatives, that the legislative process is all about balancing priorities. And Eyman doesn't ask about priorities. He asks entirely out of context, do you want to pay a gas tax or not? Without talking about the things that gas tax funds, for example. And that's been true of many of his initiatives over the years.
Like things that the gas tax funds, like money for transportation that I just saw this week that Metro is looking to lay off, I believe, 100 or 200 part-time drivers starting in August.
Yeah, he doesn't talk about the transportation, which goes to the I-976, almost really is going to decimate public transit around the state, but also has a huge impact on road building and things like bridge maintenance, which as anti-transit as Iman has been, he is, he's also decimated things that are important to people who drive exclusively. The amazing thing is that Iman is not the most anti-transit person who's running for governor. That would be Al Hurt, who has run several times for local office on the east side as somebody who is virulently anti-expansion of Sound Transit to the east side, light rail particularly. And there's a bunch of other familiar names on the ballot for governor, people like Omari Terry Garrett, who has made a name for himself over the past 20 plus years as being one of the more colorful permanent candidates in Seattle. Good Space Guy is running for governor. I'm sure he's well qualified. Alex Zimmerman, city council's best friend, is running for governor. A whole bunch of other people that you've never heard of, people from other parts of the state who are probably just as notorious in their local areas as people like Zimmerman are here. But nobody who really has any traction that I can tell other than Iman and Jay Inslee. And I think those will be the two names we see on the ballot in November. For lieutenant governor, we also have a local name that's familiar, Ann Davidson Sattler, who made the general election running for city council last year against Deborah Juarez, who did beat her easily. She was running as an independent NIMBY. Now she's running as a Republican. It's like, now she tells us. She's running for lieutenant governor. This is an open seat. The current lieutenant governor is decided not to run for reelection. The two names that are probably the best known running for lieutenant governor are Denny Heck, who is not running for reelection in District 10, Olympia, and down into Lewis County in Congress. He instead is running for lieutenant governor in Washington State. And then Markham Lilas, who is a state representative from Mukilteo, who has been the number two person in the Democratic caucus in the House for a number of years and is very well known there. Those two folks are most likely, I think, to make the general election. And those are your choices there as well. Secretary of State, we also have a familiar local name, Gentry Lang, who ran some years ago for, he first made a name for himself opposing the initiative to institute vote by mail, claiming that it would be ridden by vote fraud. He was running for the Green Party at that point. At this point, he's running as an independent and saying he's going to fix electoral fraud, whatever that is. Meanwhile, the two most well-known names on the ballot there are the incumbent Republican Kim Wyman and Democrat Gail Tarleton, who most recently has been in the state house as a representative from, I believe, District 46, and then Kim Wyman, who's the Republican incumbent there. So Gail Tarleton was also with the Port of Seattle and the commission there for some years and has sort of made a name for herself as sometimes being progressive and sometimes being very much in bed with big business. So she's kind of a mixed bag, but would probably be better in that position than Wyman has been.
Hasn't Kim Wyman gotten a fairly good reviews on her work?
She has for a Republican, which is to say she has not been engaged in the kind of voter suppression that other state Republican secretaries of state have done, which is to her credit, and she's been pretty good about that. At the same time, people are talking about wanting to see quicker implementation of same-day registration, which was passed by the legislature last year. Some other reforms that would make voting easier that have been done in other states have not been done in here, and that Gail Tarleton supports and Wyman has not supported. That's the main difference between the two of them, so far as I can tell. That and the fact that Wyman is a known quantity because she is an incumbent. And she's done an okay job. Like Sam Reed before her, she has been fairly nonpartisan in implementing the state election system, which is one of the two major things that the Secretary of State does. The other is promoting trade, and particularly out-of-country trade. And Tarleton, of course, with her background with the port, is likely to be all on board with that as well. So I don't see a whole lot of difference in that respect.
All right. On to treasurer.
Yeah. Mike Pellicotti is running for treasurer. He's taking no corporate donations and is probably the most progressive of the folks running for that. I believe that is an open seat, but I could be wrong about that. I just don't spend as much time on the treasurer's race as I probably should. State auditor is also running. The incumbent there is Patrice McCarthy. She is running against a man named Joshua Carey, who does not appear particularly well qualified for the position. So the incumbent's probably the better bet there. Attorney General, same kind of thing. Bob Ferguson was planning to run for governor, but then Inslee decided to run for a third term when his presidential race didn't really pan out. And he's, you know, that was possibly as a way of positioning himself if there needs to be a special election or a special appointment if Inslee takes a position in the Biden cabinet as, you know, EPA director or something, which is a distinct possibility. I'm not convinced that Inslee would serve a full term if Biden wins in November, but we'll see. Meanwhile, Bob Ferguson has really won a lot of praise as Attorney General for taking on major corporations, taking on the Trump administration multiple times and frequently winning in his lawsuits. Some very high-profile wins, the Muslim ban when Trump was first elected. Ferguson really took the lead on that, and he's taken the lead on a number of other really illegal, unconstitutional Trump administration initiatives that he and in conjunction with other attorneys general in different states have been challenging and winning quite frequently. So he gets plaudits for that, but he also gets a lot of plaudits for what he's been doing for Washington State consumers and taking on things like wireless companies and Comcast and some other really heavy hitters and insisting that they follow the law and how they treat the consumer. So he gets big points for that as well.
And probably not a lot of financial donations from those corporations.
I would not think so, but I would think he gets a lot of donations from ordinary folks that are making up for that. Also wanting to run for governor, and her plans were spoiled by Jay Inslee, is the Commissioner of Public Lands, Hillary Franz, who was previously, I believe, a Kitsap County commissioner. She has done a reasonably good job with Commissioner of Public Lands. That historically has been a position that manages the state land, state's forests and other public lands, and has been dominated by timber interests and Republicans. Franz has really been the first person with an environmental background to be holding that job, and she's done a really good job in terms of making sure that the state forests are managed in a renewable way and an environmentally responsible way. So she gets credit for that, and I think she'll be vastly better than any of the people challenging her at this point. The superintendent for public instruction, that also is an incumbent who's running without a lot of therapy. And then it's obvious as people try and figure out how to open public schools or whether to open public schools to in-person teaching in the middle of a pandemic. There's been a lot of parental concern about that, rightful parental concern in Washington State, given that our pandemic trends are not going well. I'll talk about that in a minute. I would go with Chris Reichdahl there. And then Insurance Commissioner Mike Kriegler has done a really exceptional job of trying to hold insurance, especially health insurance companies, accountable during this pandemic. But he had been doing a good job before as well. And I believe this is his fourth term that he's running for. And each of the past times that he's run for re-election, he's been main opposition has come from a Republican financed by the insurance industry, which kind of tells you where he's coming from, and that is the case against him as well. So I definitely go with Kriegler on that. So let's talk for a minute about the different legislative districts in Seattle. A lot of them, the incumbents are running without serious opposition. That's the case in Legislative District 11, Southeast Seattle, where Bob Hasegawa is running for re-election in the Senate, and then Zach Hudgens and Steve Berquist are running in the House. Legislative District 32 at the north end of Seattle, Sherry Sutton from Lynnwood City Council is running against Cindy Ryu, who's the incumbent, who tends to be from the fairly pro-corporate wing of the Democratic Party. But I'm not sure Sutton is much better on that. Ryu's probably the better bet there, but I could be wrong on that. And then Lauren Davis, who's definitely also a pro-corporate wing, is running in district for the second position in District 32. In District 34, Eileen Cody, who has been there for 26 years, is running for re-election. And then the other position, number two, Liz Verry is probably the best bet there. She's been endorsed by a lot of labor groups, as well as Pramila Jayapal. That is an open seat that she's running for there. In District 37, 22-year veteran Sharon Tamiko Santos does not have a lot of serious opposition in the first position. The second position is an interesting one because that's where Eric Pettigrew is retiring after many years. And there's two pretty good candidates there. People may remember Kirsten Harris Tully from the Seattle People's Party, who was briefly appointed to fill an interim position at a key time in the first battle around an employee head tax. And she acquitted herself quite well on city council, I thought, and didn't get pulled up into all the partisan rancor around that fight. The other good candidate there is Chukwundi Salisbury. He's probably best known at this point as being the brother of Omari Salisbury, who's been one of the primary reporters on the ground during the whole CHOP saga and the various protest movements over the last 7 weeks. So Chukwundi is a I think second generation immigrants, he has been very active for years in the Black community in terms of youth engagement and community engagement and things like that. I think either one of them would be very good. And it'll be very interesting to see if those are the two that emerge from the primary for the general election. In District 43, Nicole Macri has done a really good job in her relatively short time in the House of Representatives in District 1. In District 2, Frank Chop is running for re-election again. God help us. He's been there since pterodactyls were roaming the face of the earth. He is being challenged by somebody from the Seattle People's Party who identifies themselves as non-binary, Cherie Lascelles. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Lascelles has a much more progressive platform, of course, than CHOP does. CHOP has historically been much more conservative than the district he represents. District 43 is basically Capitol Hill, the U District, Wallingford, that sort of L-shaped district there. And it's one of the most liberal districts in the state. In Macri, they finally have somebody who is as progressive as their district. In CHOP, they do not. Lascelles would remedy that. The concern I have about Lascelles is that I don't think they have any particular qualifications to be in the state house. At least I can't really discern any from the website or the voter statement or the voter's video. So I have some concerns about Cherie. And again, I hope I'm pronouncing their name correctly. And it would be very cool to have a non-binary person in the state house for sure. But I'm just not sure they're up to the job. So I'd like to find out more, and I hope those are the two that go to the general election, so we can hear more from them.
Let me jump in real quick. Sure. I know they were involved with the recent Seattle City Council legislation in terms of changing the old solicitation and drug laws. So I know they were one of the the movers on getting that finally through. So at okay. least that's my understanding. So
that's good. That's nice to know. District 46 is the last district in the Seattle area. That's Northeast Seattle. And there, that one, both incumbents are running for re-election again. Neither faces any serious opposition. Jerry Paulette in the first position has, of course, been our friend from Heart of America for many years. And he's been in the state house for many years now and has done a pretty good job. And then Javier Valdez also has been a longtime activist and was elevated to the House of Representatives a few years ago in position 2 and is running for re-election there. And that is your ballot. Those are really the only items on the ballot for this primary. It's not nearly as long a primary ballot as we've seen in recent years. I don't know if that's because of the pandemic or and people just couldn't gather signatures. What we'll definitely have some ballot initiatives in November, so we have that to look forward to.
It'll be interesting to see what kind of turnout we get for it.
Yeah, that's true. Also, I would think the turnout's not going to be that badly affected since it's a vote by mail state. But
you would hope.
you would hope. But it'll be interesting to see. I'm not sure what the proportion is of people that have historically used drop boxes. And I'm not sure whether with the pandemic, whether that would stop people from going out. It seems to me that a lot of people are going out right now and not taking the pandemic as seriously as they did back in April. King County actually is now exceeding the number of daily new cases that it was having back in April. So it's not just Eastern Washington anymore. In fact, Yakima County is the only county in the state where daily cases seem to be declining at this point. It's good news. Yakima had been extremely hard hit. It's the second worst county in state in terms of number of raw cases. It has more raw cases now than Pierce County. Snohomish County still has more. So it's third in the state, but with much less population than even Pierce County. It was hit much harder per capita than any place in the state. Their numbers are starting to come down, but every place else in the state, and particularly in Puget Sound and in the rest of the I-84 corridor, going down through Tri-Cities and up to Ellensburg, is still looking really bad. So I would encourage people to stay at home if you can. And we heard from Governor Inslee on Thursday, not only freezing counties moving to phase 3 and banning gatherings of more than 10 people. I'm not sure if that's enforceable for the protest movement. I wouldn't think so. I wouldn't think they would try. But we're not supposed to have gatherings of more than 10 people at this point. And that he said he's seriously considering another stay-at-home order if the numbers continue to get worse. So it is serious. I want to underscore that. It is serious. Take it seriously. Wear the damn mask when you go outside, when you go in public, when you're around people of a margin of less than 6 feet. And, be very cautious. Wash your hands a lot. Use hand sanitizer. Do everything you were doing in April because it's just that dangerous right now. And we just passed 45,000 cases in Washington State yesterday. So it's not just the South and California that's looking bad right now. Washington State is, in fact, there was an article in the New York Times a couple days ago talking about how Washington State, seemed to have the pandemic under control earlier than most states, and now it's getting hit hard again. So it's national news is starting to notice as well. So be very careful. This is going to be with us for a while. As long as it's bad in the rest of the country, and as long as people aren't taking it seriously here, even some people aren't taking it seriously here, it's going to continue to be a serious public health concern. We'll keep an eye on that for sure.
Yeah, and tying that back into the election that's coming up, since Jay Inslee is on the ballot, how much of that, which is happening here in Washington State, falls on in his lap? How much is he responsible for?
Well, I think he's responsible for the reopening, because that's really what the process that kickstarted the resurgence of cases here. which is true in most of the rest of the country here, Inslee did not do it as recklessly as places like Arizona and Georgia and Florida and Texas did. And that's why you're not seeing, a real public health crisis here. But it is going up. It's going up in almost every state that reopened. Honestly, I don't fault Inslee too much for that. He was facing, just as governors of every state were facing, an enormous amount of pressure being generated by President Trump, by right-wing media, et cetera. You know, the orchestrated state capitol protests in Olympia and in many other states that were demanding things reopen. You know, governors had to balance that and take that into account, as well as the need to have some economic activity versus the public health concerns. And that's a tough call. So I don't fault Inslee too much for that. He has been doing it more carefully than many states. And really the only states that are doing well at this point are Hawaii, which has continuously had a 2-week quarantine for anyone coming to the islands. No other state can do that really, except maybe Alaska. And the Northeast, where they had a really horrific go of it in April and May, and were just recovering from that when everybody else was reopening. So they really missed that whole wave and are still in recovery and basically reopening much more cautiously than the rest of the country. But Washington State has not been exempt for this. Neither has Oregon, which has actually got a more serious resurgence right now than Washington State does. And of course, California was among the first states to clamp down. They were the very first state to have a stay-at-home order and was really very careful about it. And they've got a huge outbreak now. Los Angeles County alone has almost 150,000 cases, so which is, you know, three times what Washington State does with roughly 1.5 times the population. It's a tough call to balance the politics of it, the economic issues, the state's need for revenue from economic activity, and balancing all that against what would be most sensible from a public health standpoint. And, you know, nobody's been in this situation before. The frustrating part is we do have the example of other countries that have successfully not only shut down, but then reopened in such a way that they have kept the numbers low. Places like Italy, Spain, Germany, other European countries that have been very careful about reopening. Notice the UK is not on that list. France has been very careful about it. And they're getting a couple hundred new cases a day at this point for their entire countries, which is less than what King County is getting right now. So it can be done. We know the steps that it takes in order to get the pandemic under control and keep it under control. The thing is, we don't have the political will to do it. We don't have the cultural will to do it. We don't have enough shared, cultural understanding of what is necessary for people to be able to comply with things like stay-at-home orders. And then there's no national leadership on this. Donald Trump, by the end of this, is going to be responsible for hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths. Hundreds of thousands. UW came out with a new model a few days ago suggesting that by the end of October, which is to say by Election Day, there will be nearly 250,000 dead in the United States from COVID-19. Personally, I think it's going to be closer to 300,000, but those are the kind of numbers we're talking about. And that's when flu season really starts, which really amps up the risk that healthcare facilities will be overloaded in a lot of the country. You're not going to be able to see healthcare professionals and resources going from hotspot to hotspot the way they did when New York had its outbreak, for example, and then places like Detroit and New Orleans and Chicago had their outbreaks, where different states and cities were sharing resources to deal with fires. That won't be possible in fall and winter because there'll be too many fires. You can't put them all out at once, and it's going to be very, very bad, is my fear. I hope that we can be exempt from that in the Pacific Northwest, you know, relatively isolated geographically from the rest of the country. That should help. I hope, you know, we had very good compliance with the stay-at-home order in April, and that really helped bring the numbers down. And I'm hoping that that can happen again. The big political battle that's coming up, of course, is around the reopening of schools. And I'm hoping the state has the good sense not to try to do that in a reckless fashion. And I'm not sure that in any fashion that involves in-person attendance while case numbers continue to rise would not be reckless. We saw, for example, the state of Florida announced this week, and they've got the worst outbreak in the world right now. They've exceeded 15,000 new cases a day, several days. They announced a couple days ago that 31% of children being tested for COVID-19 were coming back with positive results. That's an extremely high number. In Washington State, by comparison, for all people being tested, the number is about 5%. And ideally, what you want for public health concerns is about 3%. So 31% of children are coming back positive. And we're seeing all kinds of examples from around the country, from things like summer camps, summer schools, things like that, that teachers and parents are getting the COVID-19 from the kids. They are spreading it in social settings. So at this point, no matter what Donald Trump says, reopening the schools is really dangerous. And I know the school boards are around the state are wrestling with that right now. Private schools are wrestling with it. Parents are wrestling with it. It's a huge thing to ask for parents, when we don't have a social safety net in this country that includes childcare, for example. It's really very difficult for parents to have to deal with that. Hopefully you don't have to deal with that for too long, because we know what it takes to get under control. It can be done in a couple months. We've seen that in other countries. We saw that in Washington State, and it needs to happen again because it's no longer in control in Washington State.
It's hard to take when different government representatives, including our own, are talking about the numbers. It's hard to take the numbers totally seriously when the testing is still so inadequate. I mean, it's still completely token.
Well, not only that. I mean, yeah, the testing is not widely available. And, you know, we're seeing more and more evidence that the Trump administration has been intentionally withholding testing resources. And even if you get a test at this point, the labs that process the tests are running out of equipment chemicals to run the tests. So there's now a 5 to 7 day backlog. And in some cases, the backlog is so long that it makes contact tracing impossible, because by the time you get a positive result, it's impossible to go back and figure out all the people you've been in contact with. The other thing with that is that if there's a week or 2 week gap between when you take the test and when you get results, if you get a positive result, that means if you haven't been self-isolating because you don't know that you have the virus, it means you've been spreading the virus for a week or two. So it's really very problematic. And we're also seeing shortages of PPEs, a lot of nursing homes, which were, well, the biggest original concern, saying that they're running out of PPEs. You're seeing healthcare professionals being exhausted in places like Florida and Arizona, where they've been working 24/7 for weeks.
And being laid off in large numbers.
Yeah, because the hospitals are running out of money too, because the stimulus that Congress passed to help hospitals is hospitals are running out of that money. And that brings us to another national issue, which is Congress is faced in 2 weeks with the expiration of unemployment benefit extensions for millions and millions of Americans. I think the number is 13 million. And you saw something like one third of all Americans in June were unable to pay their housing costs, either rent or mortgage. There's no help that's been forthcoming for that either. With those unemployment benefits expiring for millions of people, you're going to see a lot of people lose their housing. because the moratorium on evictions also expires in 2 weeks. So we're looking at a really serious deadline for Congress right now to try and do something. And it really shouldn't. The Senate, of course, under Mitch McConnell, has been the primary problem there. The House actually passed a package about 6 weeks ago that's been sitting on McConnell's desk ever since. The fact that they're even leaving it to the last minute like this is enormously stressful for a lot of people. And hopefully they will pass something and it will be adequate. I'm not optimistic on that, to be honest. Because Trump, for example, has signaled that he doesn't want to sign anything, even if it is passed. So we'll see. We'll see what kind of political pressure can be applied in the next couple of weeks. But it really underscores how completely dysfunctional our federal government has been, particularly the Republican Party. You have one party that has, sort of made a living off of science denial for years now. And that's how they're handling the pandemic as well. And, and when it's bad news and when it makes their dear leader look bad, they're just pretending that it doesn't exist. They have completely abandoned any effort to control this pandemic at the federal level and any effort to do anything about the depression level numbers of unemployment that are resulting. We had in the last 2 weeks, the 16th and 17th consecutive weeks of a million people or more filing for unemployment. It was 1.3 million this week, and it's well over 50 million total since mid-March. Some of those people have gone back to work, but the numbers of unemployed are still very problematic. And as with the numbers of cases of COVID-19 that have been reported, and as with the number of deaths that have been reported, we have seen states monkeying with those numbers, particularly red states monkeying with those numbers to make them look not as bad. And we've seen them being systematically underreported as well. So the CDC last week said that there were probably 10 times as many COVID-19 cases in the United States as have been formally reported. That would be 36 million. That would be 1 in 10 Americans have had COVID-19 at one point or another. And in one sense, that's good news because it means the mortality rate isn't nearly as bad as it could be. But in another, that tells you how widespread the community spread is in many parts of the country and how difficult this is going to be to get under control, particularly when you have Republican governors that are actively undermining efforts to get under control at the local level. The governor of Georgia, for example, suing the city of Atlanta over a mask requirement. Cities in Arizona and Texas begging their governors to allow them to do local controls and stay-at-home orders because they desperately need, ICU beds that have, they're basically full in Arizona, in Texas, in Mississippi, in Florida, in a number of different states. I could just go on and on. I've been doing pretty regular updates on social media on COVID-19 over the past several months. And the news is uniformly not good. The one area that is good news is the science, because the science really hasn't been affected by the politics. We know a lot more about this virus than we knew 6 months ago. And the efforts to develop a vaccine, the efforts to develop treatments and find drugs that can help with treatment are really moving quite rapidly. I think some of the optimistic news that's come out around vaccines in the last week is probably overstated. They still have to go through large-scale trials.
It usually is.
They still have to go through large-scale trials, and that's where most vaccines run into troubles because you have a large enough sample size that you can find different subpopulations for whom there are serious side effects or it doesn't work. Et cetera. The other thing is we don't know yet about the virus. If you produce antibodies, which is how many of these vaccines work, they produce antibodies in your body that will fight the vaccine when you're exposed to it. We don't know how long those antibodies last. And there's increasing evidence that it may only be for a few weeks. So the vaccine might only be effective for a few weeks. So you might have to keep taking it. And that means not just a couple billion doses of vaccine worldwide. It means several billion doses of vaccine worldwide. How do you scale up to that level of production, which is unprecedented in world history? That's going to be a huge challenge as well. And then you have distribution. How evenly is it going to be distributed? We have the three countries that are most likely to be producing vaccines, namely China, India, and the United States, all say, or their governments all say, that if they're producing the vaccine, their own citizens will take priority over everybody else. And that's not good news for the rest of the world at all, particularly if, say, India or China win the vaccine race. So you got to have vaccines for their billion plus people before anybody else gets it. So the politics of this are going to be very problematic as well. And unfortunately, the United States has set a very bad example for the rest of the world in that sense, in terms of withdrawing from WHO, in terms of refusing to cooperate in global research around the vaccine development. The United States has really made itself into a pariah state at this point. And you've had both Canada and Mexico close their borders to the United States because they don't want Americans coming into their country. And they don't even want their own people coming back from the United States because the United States is so out of control as seen through the eyes of the rest of the world. It really marks the end of the American empire in terms of the respect that the rest of the world has for us. Donald Trump has managed to do that in 3 years and 6 months.
One of the few bright spots, and put that in quotes, it appears this week that, wasn't it, United Healthcare had the best quarter returns of their history. I don't know if you saw that or not.
Oh yeah, that's great news. I'm glad that in a global health pandemic that health insurance companies are doing well. This pandemic is really the best possible argument for single payer healthcare. If you're not convinced after what we've seen over the past 6 months, you're probably never going to be convinced that access to healthcare is a serious problem in this country. You know, a lot of the differentials that we're seeing around, for instance, people of color being more badly affected by COVID-19, a lot of that has to do with access to healthcare. There's a serious class issue around access to healthcare as well. And then the next big argument after that is going to be access to housing as a uniform human right, because we're going to see a lot of people losing their housing as a result of the depression on this. We're not even remotely prepared for that at this point.
Yeah. All right. Well, still a couple more things to squeeze in if we can.
Sure. Sorry for going on like that. I can go on for another hour if you like.
We'll save that for another time.
Yeah.
Don't worry. It's not going away. Let's talk about Portland. They have been on fire for weeks now.
Yeah, for weeks. Last night was the 51st consecutive night of protests in Portland after the death of George Floyd, and the crowds last night were larger than they've been in several weeks, and they were larger specifically because of the presence of federal troops in Portland, and in particular, essentially a SWAT team from the bordering and Customs and Border Patrol, of all people, sent there by President Trump, basically as a campaign stunt, so that he can say, "See, these Democrat-run cities are out of control, and I'm the law and order candidate, and we'll bring this under control." And they've literally been roaming the streets of downtown Portland this week in unmarked vans, jumping out, snatching people, you know, without any identification, in plain clothes, snatching people, kidnapping them into the van, taking them back into the bowels of the federal building down there, and then releasing them after a few hours after questioning them. This actually is legal. This is the executive order that Trump signed, I believe, on June 26th to protect Confederate statues and other federal property. In this case, they're protecting the federal building down there. The thing is, you've got mission creep here because they're snatching people who are doing nothing more than protesting, who aren't even necessarily near any federal property, and who haven't been accused of any crime, let alone arrested. They're not being arrested. They're just being detained. And this has got a lot of people upset. And then you had a Trump administration official last night saying that Portland is just the start. We want to bring this to every city. And in fact, there's also reports out there that the CBP folks were not just sent to Portland. They were also sent to Seattle. They have not been seen yet in Seattle, but we've got three major demonstrations coming up in the next 3 days over the weekend. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see them, particularly on Capitol Hill. We'll see what happens, but be forewarned. This is something that the Trump administration wants to do for political purposes. There's plenty of academic research going back literally to the 60s saying that the best way to exacerbate civil unrest is to use law enforcement violence against it. That always makes it worse. And we're seeing that in Portland. I hope we don't see that in Seattle this weekend, but we very well could.
All right. Just got a couple minutes left. Do you want to talk about the Supreme Court rulings or?
Well, I can talk about, I can talk
about your poison.
Let's squeeze a couple of these in. The Supreme Court made a couple of major rulings last week. One, that Trump's taxes need to be made available both to Congress and to the Manhattan District Attorney. The Manhattan District Attorney one is actually the more significant one because that's a criminal proceeding. That goes out of Michael Cohen's testimony a couple of years ago that Trump increased and decreased his value of his property valuations to cheat on his taxes. And that is a criminal proceeding that's going against the Trump administration, Trump organization, and against Donald Trump personally, and is well within the statute of limitations if Donald Trump is not in office after January. And of course, one of the reasons Trump desperately needs to stay in office, aside from his own ego, is that he's going to be subject to multiple criminal proceedings as soon as he's out of office. The other ruling that didn't get nearly as much attention was in Oklahoma, and that involved treaty rights. And that was a Native American in eastern Oklahoma who said that the state police could not arrest him because he was on unceded tribal land. The treaties had never been upheld, but they needed to be. And he was on land that rightfully belonged to the Cherokee Nation. And lo and behold, the Supreme Court agreed with him. That is a huge win for Native American rights. And it didn't get very much national attention, but it certainly did in the Native American press. So I just wanted to make a note of that and celebrate it. Some rare good news this year. Very welcome news for Native American rights. The other thing I wanted to get to was noting that it's been, 3 weeks out from the revelation of Bountygate, and still not only Trump, but no Republicans in Congress are doing anything whatsoever about it. This is an entire party that's committed itself to treason, and that needs to continue to be highlighted. It's just outrageous. And you also wonder if Putin is paying Trump for every unnecessary American death from COVID-19. It would explain a lot of things.
All right. So we will talk to you again next week.
Yes, and hopefully Maria will be back as well. You won't have to listen to me ramble for an hour.
All right. Oh, Got a call. All right. We'll see you next week.
Okay. Thank you.